hearings and work sessions on three bills this afternoon, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 885, and Mr. Bacovian will read a summary of that.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 885, you did hear previously on the 22nd of March. This does require the Department of Human Services to disregard the amount of the annual cost of living that people on Social Security and Supplemental Security Income get. When they do get this increase, it automatically decreases the amounts of food stamps that they receive. This would require DHS to disregard that. We do have, and in your packet now are the Dash 2 amendments. On your staff measure summary, you still have a description of the Dash 1s, but we do have the Dash 2s. These are friendly amendments from the sponsor, and what they do is require DHS to request a waiver from the federal government to disregard this annual cost of living, and it would then repeal this if the waiver was received and approved. It would repeal it in 2016 and then require the Department of Human Services to make the application no later than October of 2005.
Okay. Yeah, Roy, would you come up, please? Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Certainly. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Roy Scheer, and I am here on behalf of the office of Senator Charlie Ringo. I'd be happy to discuss the amendments, the Dash 2 amendments. I know a lot of the details behind them. So if you have any questions for me or if you just want me to talk about them.
Well, why don't we have Sue Abrams come up also, and you guys can have kind of a discussion here because Sue is from OHS.
I do have some questions. I think the first one would be Sue. Would this be
introduce yourself.
Yeah, for the record, Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Sue Abrams. I'm the administrator of the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits in Children, Adults, and Families section of Department of Human Services.
Yeah, would a question like this be a full waiver amendment or just a plan amendment?
I actually don't know for sure the answer to that. It wouldn't be, I mean, we wouldn't waive the whole program. We would be sending in the waiver just to do this this piece. The question that's been unclear to us is if they, at the federal level, they can grant this as a waiver or they'd have to look at this as more of a demonstration project. So, which makes it a little more complicated, but we would attempt to do it as a waiver because demonstration projects require a cost neutrality.
Okay, I guess
further question.
Yeah, further question, Mr. Chair. I guess we have a lot of waivers in the pipeline, and they kind of all have a similar re-update, I think, don't they? I mean, like the Medicaid waivers are 2007 for. At this point, it appears we're just going to extend current waivers there. So I'm just wondering. The couple questions I had was how much is actually going to be involved in doing this? How much time commitment and things like that on top of everything else that needs to be reauthorized? And my other question was when you look at. At the sunset of 2016, that requires us to continue the exception through two more cycles. And I'm wondering why we're doing that. If this is a demonstration, should the time frame be for the next waiver period?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, in the food stamp program, I think, you know, when you think of waivers in Medicaid and TANF, it's a lot different than the food stamp program.
Okay.
In the food stamp program, it is, it's not as cumbersome. We have lots of waivers in the food stamp program. The program allows for us to request waivers, and we do that when we can. But it is unclear to us, though. We have not had conversations with the federal agency, so it's unclear to us how receptive they will be to this request for a waiver. But in terms of our workload, and it's pretty minimal for us to do the request. come.
Okay, the time frame.
If I might speak to that, the sunset clause issue. The rationale behind including a sunset clause in this bill was that the decisions of the USDA are not necessarily constant. This isn't necessarily an automatic procedure. There's a number of conditions that may affect whether USDA decides to approve the waiver, deny the waiver, or approve the waiver with conditions. And so the rationale behind reapplying for the waiver is to gauge whether or not DHS or the USDA will be receptive to this.
Yes.
I understand that, and I don't know the time frames of this. I guess I was assuming most waivers have similar time frames. That may not be true.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, seeing from what you said, that it appears that USDA is an easier agency to work with than CMS. So so maybe CMS needs to take some lessons from USDA on this. But I guess if I was proposing this, I would sunset it at a point in time where a new extension would be in place. But excuse me, Mr. Chair, that's all. I'm not as familiar, obviously, with these waivers as I am with the CMS waivers. So.
Would you like to continue, or would you like to? You have. You're in opposition to the bill. Okay. Could you tell us why you're in opposition?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee. Well, we agree with the intent of the bill and what it's trying to do to help Social Security and SSI beneficiaries kind of receive the full benefit of their annual cost of living increase, rather than see it eroded by decreasing some of their food stamp benefits. Because there is a fiscal, we believe there'll be a fiscal impact.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the waivers is not a problem. Requesting the waivers is not a problem. However, depending on what and if we are to get those waivers, what this would look like, we believe there will be a fiscal, because it will require us to change our computer systems, because currently we have automatic matches with Social Security. We update the records with the new Social Security amount. So we know that there's going to be some impact, but we aren't able to assess that at this point until we really know what it would look like.
Okay. I don't think this was marked as a fiscal impact yet, but you don't know how significant that would be. You have no way of knowing.
No, Chair Moore said, and I don't think we can determine that till we know what and if USDA is willing to approve.
Let me ask you another question. You have other objections to the bill other than the fiscal impact?
Chair Morissette, no. It was mainly that it's not in the governor's budget, and we'll leave it all out of fiscal.
So if we pass this bill, it will go to the Ways and Means Committee, and they will make a decision. Yes, of course.
At some point, with enough, maybe more time, could DHS project possibly if, for example, if it came back and said, do A, B, and C, a potential impact that might occur? I know you're only projecting out at this point. Is that within the realm of possibility?
Yeah, Chair Morissette, Mr. Bacobian, I think I'm not a systems person, so I'm speaking for our systems people, but I think what we could do is do some assumptions about implementing this in the easiest way possible, and then ask that our systems folks tell us what that would take to do, and the simplest being, at this point we're thinking, is that when somebody comes to apply and they are getting any of these benefits, mm-hmm. we would put the amount of that benefit on the system and then somehow have to stop the automatic update when the cost of living increases, and those matches that we have with Social Security around the automatic increase of the income. The complexity comes in is because there's more than one system that does this match. So other, like the Medicaid benefits, TANF benefits, all those other ones would have to have the automatic update and have to stop it for food stamps. And that's where it's unclear to me how complex this would be. Sometimes you think these things should be simple, and they're not. So I think that's probably what the conversation we'd have with our systems folks.
Other questions? Yes.
Comment. We don't have a fiscal on this. Let's send it to the floor and we can figure out later how side, or they can come with numbers later. I think that we ought to move this, and we're getting down to the end of time we're supposed to be hearing bills. They'll have plenty of time to figure out if there's a large enough fiscal to go to Ways and Means.
Well, I know what will. Thank you. I know what will happen is if we pass this out, it will. The president's office is going to take a look at this, and they will make a decision, I'm sure. But I agree that I guess on the merits of the bill, I agree with what we're trying to do. I think it would help if we were able to make some adjustments, allowing people to get the benefits of that. Because of things that happened that are no fault of their own. What about the sunset? Why do you set it for the 2016?
Well, we figured a 10-year sunset clause would be, enough time to determine whether or not the USDA over that period of time would be receptive to such a waiver. So that would give us some administration changes, some changes in the economy, changes in federal budgets.
Now, I will ask the question of, did you consult with people who make these kinds of decisions in terms of sunset time and information that you might gather? I'm Senator Cruz, do you feel this is an unreasonably long period of time for the sunset?
Well, I mean, the way it's written, the way the bill is written, Mr. Chair, it asks DHS to submit an application for a waiver. It doesn't say anywhere in here that they keep resubmitting and resubmitting. And so, at this point it appears that the bill asks the question and then we deal with the answer, unless I'm not reading something in here.
Well, Chair Morissette, yeah. Senator Cruz, well, I'm reading the -2 amendments, and I believe in there what's changed is that they do ask us to annually submit an application, which I think is the first. So, it's like I say, submitting the waiver request is fairly simple for us. We're not believing, although we haven't had the conversation, we're not believing that USDA will be all that receptive to this, but we don't know. And I'm unclear sort of if they do deny the waiver, if then we're submitting it every year to them for 10 years,
right.
And how angry will that make them? That's unclear. Or once we get an answer, that's the end, or, I'm just a little unclear sort of how we would manage that.
Yeah, and it gets down, I guess, because this is outside of the box, clearly, at this point in time. And I understand, if you look historically at, like, our first Medicaid waiver, how many years it took to get that, but then you're going to factor in it took a lot of hours and a lot of work and a lot of trips to D.C. and a whole lot of other things to bring that off. Now, clearly, this isn't as complicated. But it's also very speculative, and I guess if Department of Ag says no, and then you go back next year and ask them, and they say hell no, and you go back next year and ask them, and they say Oregon is secede from the union, we want nothing more to do with you. So,
I'm going to speak to that. My understanding is that assuming that USDA does approve this waiver, the waiver has to be applied for annually. So no matter what, we're going to have to keep on applying for the waiver in order for it to be a permanent change in or in the food stamp program. So, essentially, if they deny it 1 year, what our rationale, as I said before, is on this is that, what may be deniable 1 year may be acceptable another year to the USDA.
Yes, did you have another?
Yeah, I guess you know, sometimes discretion, Ms. Chair, is a better part of valor, and I'm not sure asking the same question over and over under the same, you know, doing the same thing, expecting different results is a definition of insanity. And, you know, I mean, clearly
a commission... That is a definition of insanity.
It is. It's always worked for me, and which is why I'm certifiable. But, I mean, you're right to a degree. Administration change, philosophies change, and all that, but they don't necessarily... I mean, this, and if it was approved and it had to be reapplied for every year, that's okay. But this calls for a reapplication, whether it's approved or not, every year. And I'm just not sure that there shouldn't be some discretion in there for.
I would like to have a work session to send this to the floor. The president, I think, we'll have something to say about this. I think it's a good bill, and the intent is good. It will probably end up in Ways and Means, and whether or not it ever gets out of Ways and Means, we don't know. But I would like to move it along. If we have the votes, one of them just walked out the door. So in a moment...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to put my...
Yes.
I know that there are a number of elderly that live just off of their Social Security, as your person did. And they did get a raise, but in the public sector, when you do get a raise, then usually your benefit goes down. And I know that because of those people that are on self-sufficiency programs. If they earn a little bit more money, then they don't get quite as much help to pay their rent or their utilities. And it is a very small amount. But I would be opposed to this bill because of that. Yes, we don't have enough money, or those who live solely on Social Security don't. But they did... get a raise, so that is, I mean, it's not much, but it was significant enough where, you know, that means they were expected to use some of their own money, the $10 difference out of their $37 or $16 raise to be added to that, and that's why I will be a no on this.
Make emotions for you, Ms. Chair. Let's figure it out. So huh? When you go into work session, make emotions for minutes.
Okay. We're going to close the public hearing. Thank you very much. And we're going to open work session on Senate Bill 885.
Ms. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 885.
Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 885. Do we have any concerns with that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to object to the amendments because I think there's ambiguity in there that should have been cleared up.
Okay, let the record show that Senator Cruz, who made the motion to move...
and who is certifiable, is ambiguous and...
objects to his
own motion.
With no further comments, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 885 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 885 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Senator Metzger?
Why is that weird? Aye.
Senator Von Sanderson?
No.
Senator Trump?
Aye.
The bill passes on its way to the floor, and Senator Ringo will have the great honor of carrying his own bill. Thank you.
All right.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 885 and open a work session on a public hearing, on Senate Bill 895. Would you read the description? Sign-up sheet.
Senate Bill 895 requires the Department of Human Services to provide child abuse investigators with continuing education.
I'm ready.
On constitutional statutory rights of children and families during all phases of investigations into allegations of child abuse. It also requires Department of Human Services and law enforcement upon oral receipt of child abuse and initial contact with the individual to inform the person of the specific allegations and applies to investigations commenced on the Act. You do have the Dash 1 amendments. These are amendments from the sponsor of the bill that eliminates in the last portion of the bill that law enforcement must inform the person under investigation about specific allegations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Swanson, would you come up, please?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 895. I'd like the committee to know that the department supports the concept completely. We agree that our caseworkers need to conduct their child abuse assessments within the parameters of the law. I need to, however, today oppose this bill because there is a fiscal impact. We have talked with the Department of Justice and have discussed the idea of their developing a videotape for us to provide to our workers for training. It was clear to us in looking at this that the area of constitutional law is very complex, and it's not an area that we have expertise in. Our workers are social workers, they're caseworkers, and we don't have that kind of training, but the Department of Justice would be available to us to create a videotape that we could use in that training, and we agree that it would be a good concept.
Okay, you do contract with the Department of Justice, correct?
The Department of Justice represents us and assists us in our work, yes.
Kevin Neely, could you come up, please? As long as we're talking about you, you should be here. I guess my question is, it just seems to me that the Department of Justice, under contract with the various agencies, I don't know if this would be included in an existing contract or would be extra to... would you identify your head nods, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I'm the Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. I also am the guy who does the fiscal impact statements for the department. I can tell you that, as Ms. Swanson indicated, the Department of Justice will charge our normal billing rate for the production of this video. Additionally, there'll probably be a little bit of production charge. We have taken a look at the amount, and in fact, I think when DHS established their testimony on this, we were looking at the possibility of about $5,000 fiscal impact. We have been reviewing that a little bit more closely since we last made that report to the Department of Human Services. We think we can probably do it for a little bit less than that because some of the legal research has already been completed. But again, I think the thing that's important to remember here is it's not just a matter of our attorneys providing basic legal advice and making a videotape. We have to do a little bit of the underlying legal research before we get to that point. And again, that probably would take a little bit of time, and we would charge our normal billing rate. Which,
no, you're not talking 3 to 5 million. You're talking
three to five thousand.
I skipped over that just to see if.
I'm sorry.
3 to 5.
I should have clarified that. Mal's not talking about $3 to $5.
$3 to $5,000 is a bargain.
Well,
that's not bad. You wouldn't do it. Okay. Let the record show. Okay, 3 to 5 thousand. Now, are we just talking a video, or are we talking some instructional written material that would go with that, or is that additional?
Mr. Chair, I think we could do the whole kit and caboodle for $3,000 to $5,000. I think it would probably include written materials, but we'd only need to do those written materials once because they don't want to pay their attorneys $110 an hour to copy them.
Now, we don't have a fiscal listed on this bill, so I will pretend that I didn't hear what you said, and we will send this bill to the floor, And if there's a question about the fiscal, I would encourage them to check with you, because that is not, in the scheme of things, a large fiscal for some of these bills. And some, you know, we are sending, if they look very carefully, they will send anything to fiscal that even smells like it has, or to Ways and Means, I mean, that even smells like it has a fiscal. They missed this one. The Smith test did not seem to work in this bill. So we will take advantage of that, for the record, and send this. I hope we can move this to the floor. I hope.
I know, he is. 5,000 is below 50. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Roger, would you please come up and tell us why we should take this risk?
This risk to your careers, yes.
Yeah. And you're going to carry the bill.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Good.
It's a good bill.
Good bill. I think it's a good bill. Now, Roger, you're not going to read all that stuff.
Yeah.
No. I'm a very slow reader.
Oh.
I think Mr. Chair falls in a category of, you know, bill or talk.
Yeah.
Not the bill.
Yeah, bill or talk. You want the bill or do you want to talk?
That's what you said to the foster parents too.
Oh, okay.
That's
just very briefly tell us. Make your.
I will make this fairly quick. My name is Roger Williams, for the record. I'm a legislative coordinator for Ocean Network, which is a statewide homeschooling organization. I'm giving you two pieces of paper. One is, the thin one is the...
No,
the
slow down.
Okay. Thank
not
you.
Too much, though.
He knows me so well.
I know.
Because he knows I get jittery.
I don't want you to get jittery.
Thank you. There's two pieces. One is the actual federal bill, CAPTA, and it has the actual language, and it has the intent of Congress reports in it. And then the other one is a sample, actually it's a draft training manual on this exact subject, which Homeschool Legal Defense Association has developed, and I don't have a copy of it, but the state of Texas has already developed a manual. So you got two pre-existing bases for training. The first thing about the fiscal is this CAPTA bill is a spending bill. It's a spending bill, and these provisions are conditions for getting the money, mm-hmm. and these conditions are basically what this bill that you're looking at says. So it's almost like it's close. It's close. We did some dickering it, but it's close. So the reality is, for $3,000 to $5,000of expense, you're making sure that you continue to get this money from the federal government. And if you don't have these provisions in place, then the conditions say you're not eligible for the money from the feds. So that, just to set that in perspective. We made two changes to the initial bill. One is we asked to exclude law enforcement personnel from being covered, and frankly, we didn't intend for them to be covered in the first place. Somehow that got put in during the legislative council part, and we deleted the word specific and specific allegations. And we had Kamala Sugar, who was representing the District Attorneys Association on this bill, and our attorney back east, they had about an hour discussion, which I thought was very interesting. But basically, we decided we're going to follow the federal pattern. The federal language does not have the word specific in it, so we deleted that. But what the federal language, what the federal intent of Congress says. I think on page two is where it started. And down here, page two, this is the House talking the House language, about halfway, no, the second sentence. The committee firmly believes that individuals being investigated for alleged child maltreatment should be informed of the specific allegations made against them. And then their bill, they say their bill addresses this. So they interpreted their language to mean specific. Now, we're not talking about they need to tell every detail about what happened. What they're talking about is to give the accused, in this case, or the suspected person, enough information to be able to defend themselves, to be able to say, what are you talking about? And to be able to, and if it's a sexual abuse thing, then they can say, look, I'll take my child to the doctor, or to another professional, and have them talk with my child in a safe environment, and then we will give that information back to you, so that they have enough information to defend themselves. That's the point. On the third page, the Senate intent of Congress language went even further. The last sentence there, the committee recognizes that it is a basic right for all citizens to be informed of what crime they are being accused of at the time they are being asked for an interview or entry into their home. That's the level that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about anything which would be detrimental in the larger scheme of things. I should say one other thing about that this is based on the federal bill, the federal law. My understanding is that if this bill does not pass and the state of Oregon does not train its workers, its social workers, then if there is a Fourth Amendment violation, then the state of Oregon will be more liable and the social worker will be more liable. The Ninth Circuit Court, which were under their jurisdiction, in the Calbetta case, where basically a social worker came to the door and threatened the mother and got entrance in, and then they sued for violation of Fourth Amendment. That social worker was personally held liable. So this bill will actually be a protection for our social workers here in Oregon if they're properly trained. So, low-cost training options. I'll just say this, and I think this will be it. I've given you a sample manual, and like I say, State of Texas already has one. We can, State of Oregon can build on either one of those two. There is an existing symposium for Oregon State Police. It's the Jasper Mountain Symposium on Child Abuse, and I've got a contact person, Susie Johnson, for who runs that. And my understanding is that Department of Human Services has a standing invitation to come to that. Now they may not want to do that, but at least they could take a video of that symposium. So, but we're only talking $3,000 to $5,000 here for the professionals to do it. So why? We don't even have to go there. So I guess what I'm saying is, fiscally, if you pass this, you continue to get the federal money, and you pay $3,000 to $5,000. If you don't pass this, you risk losing the federal money, and you raise the liability of both the state of Oregon and the individual social workers for not being well trained. It's a failure in the duty to train your workers. That's what that is.
Question. Thank you.
Let's include the bill.
Kevin, did you have anything to add?
Remove the bill. No.
We will close the work session on Senate Bill 8. No, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 895, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 895.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 895.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the Dash One amendments to Senate Bill 895.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I have concerns about this this bill. And I just bring it forward just because of the types of... we have multidisciplinary teams in every county, and that's where you have the social workers or whoever's involved with the child abuse cases. We discuss these. We have attorneys there. We have police there. We have nurses there. Whoever, as it's a team with a broad spectrum, and these types of issues are dealt with. And when we're getting into constitutional protections, there's just too many, I think, questions legally, and I just have a concern. Now, having a video is fine, but I'm not sure that's going to solve the problem regarding the constitutional statutory rights of children and families during an investigation. Anyway, I feel it's a little bit more complex than what, and I have to be a no because I just don't feel that this is a good bill.
Okay. Other comments? You want to go ahead and make the final motion? We'll.
So we need to approve the Dash One first.
Okay. Other comments about the Dash Ones? Okay. Seeing no other comments, so move the Dash Ones.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 895 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 895 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. I'd like to say that I have great faith in the Attorney General's office in terms of coming up with the guidance for this, which would fit, it will fit the Constitution, but still I think we'll run it through the AG's office and they will make sure that it is properly constructed. Whether or not we have written as well as the video, I think this should evolve. I think it's a good thing. I've known several instances where these questions have come up locally. I'm not sure that we have adequate staff training. In fact, I'm not sure we have adequate staff. I spend a lot of time on the phone with Mickey Cerise on these kinds of issues, and I trust him to get to the bottom of them. So I see this as a step forward. There is some fiscal, it's not a whole lot, and I'm hoping that we can simply move this bill to the floor, to the House, to the governor for the signature. So with that, we will call the roll.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Juan Sanders?
No.
Senator Charles Starr?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 895 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 895, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1026. Would you read the summary, please?
Thank you, Senator. We did hear this on the 7th of April. Basically, Senate Bill 1026 does require that insurance carriers also include prostate specific antigen tests and digital rectal examinations on an annual basis to men who are age 50 and older, and then for men who are younger than 50 who are at risk for prostate cancer. It does establish this is required of all state regulated insurers. And then the original bill does establish the act is not subject to the automatic repeal. We do have the Dash One amendments that were discussed in the last meeting from the sponsors' approval that deletes the exemption from the automatic repeal on the 6th anniversary. There is also a fiscal impact statement on the original bill, but from what I understand, the Dash One amendments would not affect this. Fiscal impact, basically within the fiscal impact, it does state that Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield has stated this would have incur a cost of $1.75 per member per month. That's at the bottom of page one, and then local governments, the county, the city county insurance services have indicated, and again, they're basing this on Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield assumptions, that would cost them a $2 per member per month increase. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we don't have anybody signed up to testify. But we do have Kathy from PEB. Kathy, would you mind coming up, please? You didn't sign up, but I called PEB and demanded that you be here.
That was my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me?
That was my understanding.
Okay, would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Kathy Loretz. I'm the Director of Operations for the Public Employees Benefit Board.
Okay. And I guess what we want to know is the extent of the fiscal. It's been kind of fuzzy and floating around. What you're talking about is raising the cost to the state for providing insurance by offering this as a mandate, is what you're...
Yes, Mr. Chair. If we were to continue to contract with the Regents in 2006, they would increase our per member per month rates by $1.75 per member per month.
Okay. John Powell, could you please come up?
How many, Mr. Chair, how many members do we have?
Senator Modest Anderson, Mr. Chair, that was based on 106,000 members.
John, would you introduce yourself, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon.
You sent out a letter and talked to us about a different calculation than you had made before, and the question that came up, one of the questions that came up was, what if we amended the bill to say a bi-yearly checkup rather than annual, biannual?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I did call Regents and they said you could basically cut the fiscal in half.
Okay. Do you offer that on a biannual basis anyway? I mean, if you're already offering it, why is there a fiscal?
Well, Mr. Chair, currently in the PEB program, it is my understanding that it's not offered on a scheduled benefit basis. In commercial plans that Regents has developed over the last 2 years, they do offer in those commercial plans a wellness benefit of $200 for people over 35 every other year. So that benefit is $200 per insured individual every other year for a wellness checkup. Now, if you mandated certain expenses, such as these tests, then unless that contract was changed, that would be in addition to that $200, which would expand the cost of the total benefit package.
Okay. Maybe I don't really understand the mandate. A mandate isn't requiring the person to have the test, is it? A mandate allows the person to have the test.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yeah. If they do, it requires payment by the insurer.
But I guess I'm still not quite clear. You don't cover the full cost of an exam every other year currently, is that right? You do not cover the full cost of an exam on a biannual basis.
Mr. Chair, all I know in terms of the PEB program is that this particular test or these tests and exam are not specifically covered on a wellness program annually or biannually in the PEB program. They are covered if a physician needs to diagnose a possible illness.
Okay. One more question. If a PEB insured PEB employee goes to the doctor and has the typical office exam and the doctor says, I think you ought to follow through on this, and he makes a referral for a test, will you pay for it on a biannual basis?
Mr. Chair, it would depend on the doctor's notes and as to the reason. If this was part of just an annual physical,
Okay. Then
it would not. If you were going in because you did not feel well or through part of a wellness exam, the doctor felt that there was a medical reason or a medically necessary reason to have that test, then it would be paid for.
My experience with my doctor is that I have had an in-office exam annually for quite a while. He's never indicated any reason for me to have an exam, the kind of exam we're talking about. If he did, and we've had this discussion, I'm on a different plan, I guess, but I'm assuming if the doctor says, yes, I think you ought to have a test, you ought to follow through on this, and wrote that note in that way, then it would be covered on a biannual basis for a PEB patient fully insured by your company.
Mr. Chair, at my age and your age, it'd probably be covered.
Oh. Okay, then that leads to the gradation or the age groups, and I think we went through this before, but I just don't see this as being a big deal in terms of, you know, if you are, okay, we need to talk about whether we want to go to a biannual or an annual, and that's a discussion we might want to have because I think it would make a difference in terms of the fiscal impact. So anything else that you want to add to that? Okay.
For the question?
Comment.
Yes, thank you. Senator Starr.
Seems to me as we're...
You want to comment to those gentlemen?
I do, to both of these folks.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Seems to me in the calculation of premium costs, you must also consider the savings, the discovery benefits to the insurer when you don't have to treat a person very expensively for 8 years, as my good friend Luther Fitch has been treated, way over $100,000 a year for 8 years. Most of those who are discovered early don't have that kind of cost. Not only are lives saved, but costs are saved, substantial costs. Why would a low-cost medical procedure that saves substantial many lives would require an increase in premium is beyond me. Don't understand.
Yeah, no, I don't either. Okay.
Well, let's have John respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it and from an actuarial standpoint, I don't know how exactly they would view that. But in just raw numbers, if you take the number of lives subject to a relatively low-cost exam, understanding that what we used to think of as low-cost is not as low as one might think. If you go into a doctor, you've got the charges of the physician and the lab tests and that sort of thing. So a visit where you are examined extensively is a relatively expensive total procedure nowadays. Having said that, the total number of people who actually contract cancer is relatively small. If it was 50% of us, then those savings would be massive enough to offset a lot of these numbers. But fortunately, few of us, particularly younger people, contract prostate cancer. It's my understanding if we all lived long enough, we probably all would. So if the number of people who had long-term treatment were very high in numbers, then I think your point would be right on target. I think that is not the case. And so on an annual basis, these repetitive tests and that cost overwhelm savings costs. So, and I'm testifying with some hesitancy because I am not an actuary and I have not looked at it in those details. But we get into this with many other situations like contraceptives for pregnancy. Of course, pregnancy is a disease that ultimately...
Disease?
Excuse me.
condition.
A condition that...
a man's point of view.
is a condition that the majority of people ultimately want to get.
And there's cure.
And so, again... yeah, it does prevent it for a while, but ultimately you want it so you have the cost of preventing it and the cost of delivery, etc. So we get into these same debates about why the savings of wellness care do not dwarf or the cost.
Yeah,
follow up.
Senator Stark.
Also, it seems to me that... because most of we men seem to think we live forever, that a very small percentage of the male population will avail themselves of this test. I say very small. I mean less than 100% certainly, and I'd have to put myself in that category, I'm afraid.
But, Mr. Chair, you're accurate. Not everybody avails themselves of the wellness benefits. 100% of women do not, even though there is a mandate in the law paying for those exams and mammograms. Many health centers, you know, Kaiser Permanente at one time had a special program trying to contact almost every female member. And I think the highest they got was about 70% in that case. But you're right, not everybody avails themselves of the test. And there are some who, in the case of the PSA test, do not believe that the PSA test is something you should have all the time.
Thank you. Before, go ahead and introduce yourself, and then I'll come to you in just a moment.
Sure. Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans.
Thank you, Elise. Sue, don't leave yet. What's the basis of the fiscal? Is this information that you received from Regents? Is that obviously, did you get the numbers from Regents?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did. This was based on 15,000 men over the age of 50.
Okay.
And assuming that they had an exam that cost $160.
Mm-hmm.
Then they subtracted out what they currently pay, which is about $300,000 per year. And then they took that remaining $2.1 million and spread it over the 100,000 plus lives that we currently have at Regents, coming up with $1.75 per member per month.
Now, wait a minute. I'm sorry. So you have 15,000. Go through the first part again. The 15,000 over 50 who are likely to have the...
Not whether or not they're likely, just 15,000 men over the age of 50 are currently enrolled with Regents.
Right, okay.
Okay. Then they assume that the cost of the exam, that would be the doctor's exam and everything, was $160. They currently pay about $300,000 for these exams, so they subtracted that out so that they wouldn't charge us twice in this fiscal. That left about $2.1 million, and they took that and spread that over the 100,000 members that we currently have.
Now, okay, and I guess we're talking about an annual exam, mm-hmm. and that we're talking about out of the 15,000. I don't know how many people would have it annually, are you assuming, or are they, I should ask John this, but is that the maximum number, I wonder, or is that splitting it down the middle, or?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that that is the maximum number. They did not, I don't believe that they have any, they did not go through and figure out how many men under 50 might,
yeah.
might
okay.
fit into that, so they just went with the straight cost.
Well, I mean, that point is valid. That's one thing I'm thinking, I mean, first of all, in terms of numbers, because, I mean, that's not actuarially sound. I'm not an actuary, but I know enough about actuarial analysis, but if you say you've got 15,000 men and you multiply the cost and making the assumption that 100% of the pool is going to do that, I mean, it's like saying that car insurance, everybody's going to have an accident, and therefore, no, it's based on incident model. And so you would have to do a calculation of what the anticipated, based on past experience, of men actually availing themselves of that to actually figure out what that is. I mean, I don't know what the number would be, but it wouldn't be on, you don't presume your car insurance that everybody has an accident, and therefore, otherwise we'd be all paying $10,000 a year for car insurance. So we have to have an idea of how many people would actually utilize that to, to talk, then to analyze the cost, then to see what that, assessment would be. In terms of my confidence in the number, that would not give me that confidence number. For those plans that provide this, the private carriers who would provide this, I'm sure have numbers on how many people who have access to certain services actually use those services. And that would be a good way to get an idea of what actually would, what the anticipated utilization and therefore cost would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the numbers that are given to us, we don't.
Well, I'm just saying that I'm making a judgment on that number would not be correct.
I can see your point, but this is what Regents told us, that if this passes, that was what they would do with our rates, is raise them by $1.75.
Could you straighten us out, please?
My goodness, I hope I can. I think what you wanted me to
reintroduce you.
Mr. Chairman, Elise Brown representing America's Health Insurance Plans, and I joined John here at the table last week to simply state, in addition to what he told you, that the other plans have similar wellness programs, as he mentioned. But what I told you that was standard operating procedure for the rest of the plans in Oregon is if the doctor orders the test, it's done on an annual basis. Senator Metzger brought up the numbers. Again, I'm not an actuary either, but if that information would be helpful to you, I'm happy to get it for you.
That's just in terms of if we make decisions based on what the cost is going to be, that would be helpful.
That would be. I think we're going to get into. We're probably going to close the work session, either public hearing, and carry it over until we get an amendment that we will consider changing it to a biannual. It seems to me that if a given person goes in and the doctor recommends a test, that they will get the test. I'm assuming, period, from whatever policy. And I don't think too many people are going to take that test every year or every other year unless there's a reason for it. I think the prudent person will take the test if it's advised by the doctor. Now, Senator Starr, how do you feel about that? Do you think that there has to be a yearly exam? There's a yearly exam when you go to your doctor for a checkup. There is that much that we have.
The digital exam is a part of the normal annual exam.
Right.
That part
is
paid for. The PSA semi-annually would.
Or biannually.
Biannually.
So I think what we'll do then is we'll go ahead and close the public hearing, and if you could get us whatever information you can on the figures that you were talking about, that would be great. And
I just had a point here. Just thought that this one of those I actually heard the other testimony on previously, and there's a couple things concerns I would have on this. Number, just to add to the mix of your thinking, I think I would be more comfortable with the biannual. Again, if you're at risk, the doctor is always going to have the prerogative to do what they need to do for your better health, and if you've got a family history or other reasons, they're going to do that. I know my own physician, and that's only one, but is a leader in this area, doesn't recommend unless there's a reason that you don't.
Now, are you the leader, or is he the leader?
He's the leader. It doesn't recommend, for example, the PSA test until you're 55. And, you know, the reason for that is that if people get this in high numbers, high percentage, it will come back into an area that would give you concern, and it's false. It's a false concern. But then it puts you into a decision of making decisions at a younger time in life that you probably, shouldn't have to make, and may not have a good outcome. So, and that's why he says, the group that he's provided, they actually say it's 55 rather than 50, unless again, you have some history on it. But just with that thinking on it, the suggestion of the dying would make me feel more comfortable if we're going to stay at 50, because you always have that fallback position is that, your doctor feels this is in your best interest to do that, you can go ahead and do that. But I don't know if I necessarily want to encourage everybody to have a test that has high numbers of responses on it that, make people do things that probably isn't in their best interest necessarily.
I guess I raise another question on how reliable the in-office test is. And Senator Starr, I wonder if that's why you're concerned about having the PSA test. Is there some... Do you think the doctor's in-office exam is sufficient unless there is an emergency? Can they identify?
Pretty good at it, but okay. It's not perfect.
It's not conclusive. But if the doctor orders an exam, there will be an exam.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, if a person wants to have the exam just to make sure after a certain point they are eligible for a biannual exam without the doctor's recommendation, or would that be with the doctor's recommendation?
There is one plan that has an annual benefit, but I am speaking for the majority in that it is recommended by the doctor.
Okay. So, again, I think I agree with Senator Metzger that this is not going to be I don't think this is a very large pool. If the doctor, because of family history or because of signs that there could be something there, would recommend at least a biannual exam. And I would be interested in knowing, what the numbers look like if they can be tracked. I mean, out of that 15,000, how many would actually be in there with a biannual exam? I think it would be rather low myself. But yes.
Would it be possible, since I understand commercial user utilization rate is different than a state employee kind of pool, state place maybe a little bit heavy utilizers, to find what? Do we know of other states that have, for example, annual prostate exam within their benefit plans to know what their utilization is? I don't know how hard that would be to find. I guess my second question is, this information, is this going to impact Regents, assumptions, the information you're going to come back with? Is this something that you'll present back to Regents?
I think that today Regents is negotiating a new plan with PEP. Today or tomorrow. We're in the negotiation stage, so this might be a good time to talk.
Pardon me? You're correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so this is a really good time to talk about.
Well, we're not negotiating. We're in the process of choosing our plans for next year. We have not yet made the decision which plans will be contracted.
Well, this is still a good time to talk.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. I just took my father in for an exam, and the doctor says, it's been 3 years since you've had a prostate exam. I'll give you one. But he did not order a prostate-specific antigen test because there's no history and no indication. And I just want to put on record that... we're always looking at cost containment, and we have series of bills that we're trying to have cost containment. And one of the ways we can have cost containment is to allow the insurers to have flexibility in determining the contracts that they set up with the various agencies. And so I think we need to remember that even though you think it may save money, this is just a philosophical view that I think we need to be very careful with what we're mandating, especially when there's new technologies, et cetera, and when we have a statute that we're going to have a prostate-specific antigen test and then something else comes up that's even a better test. You know, it's just things that we need to keep on record.
Senator Scott.
Yes, I think that's very interesting discussion. When we've just mandated the female protections to be covered, the exams for women, and we're worrying about a less costly test for men that might save my life sometime. That's arguing both sides of the issue, I'm thinking.
The incident of prostate cancer is higher in men than breast cancer in women, but there's a higher mortality rate in women from the information you gave us last time. But the incidence of finding cancer, prostate cancer, is higher than breast cancer for women. So I think that is an interesting point. Okay.
I think we've had enough today.
Yeah. Okay. And, okay. Any other words of wisdom? Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing, and we will close the committee hearing, and we will bring this bill back on Thursday with an amendment, and we'll move it somewhere.
I'd like to.
Oh, you will.
I'm going to have breakfast with Luther on Friday.
Because they can't get it here.